Good morning, and welcome to Way Too Early, the show that is trying to forget that baseball exists. I'm Jonathan Lemire on this Monday, September 27th. We'll start with the news, and we've got a lot of it. We begin on Capitol Hill, where House Democrats are racing against the clock to pass President Biden's sweeping infrastructure agenda. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi will gather the caucus for a meeting tonight to discuss what she is describing as, quote, a time of intensity. That's because, in addition to attempting to pass two infrastructure bills, which have divided the moderates and progressives in her party, the House and Senate must pass a resolution this week to avoid a government shutdown. Government funding is set to expire just after midnight on Friday, launching finger-pointing from across the aisle over who was responsible for raising the debt limit. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen says that without congressional action, the government may be unable to pay its bills by mid-October. Despite the crowded timeline, Speaker Pelosi is delaying a vote on the smaller of President Biden's two bills. Pelosi announced yesterday that the vote on infrastructure, which was originally planned for today, will now take place on Thursday. She says this will give Democrats more time to negotiate the $1 trillion price tag and its implications on the larger $3.5 trillion social spending bill. Some Democrats, including Washington State's Pramila Jayapal, who chairs the Congressional Progressive Caucus, have insisted that they will not vote to approve the smaller bill without assurances from moderates that they'll support the larger one. Yesterday, Pelosi expressed confidence that Democrats would unite this week.
You know, I'm never bringing a bill to the floor that doesn't have the votes. You cannot choose the date. You have to go when you have the votes. In a reasonable time, and we will. Let me just say we're going to pass the bill this week.
Pelosi also conceded yesterday that the larger spending bill will likely need to be cut down, though it's unclear just how low progressives are willing to go.
I know the Budget Committee passed a resolution calling for $3.5 trillion, but it sounds like you acknowledge that the final number is going to be somewhat smaller than that.
Yeah, I mean, that seems self-evident. Senate and the House, those who are not in full agreement with the president's rate. Let's see what our value. Let's not talk about numbers. Let's dollars. Let's talk about values.
Democratic Senators Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona have both previously said they would not support a $3.5 trillion reconciliation bill. Manchin has previously proposed a price tag near $1.5 trillion, an amount which progressives balked after already negotiating down from their original figure of $6 trillion. To Germany now, where for the first time in 16 years, a new party will likely lead the country's government. Germany's center-left Social Democratic Party won the biggest share of the vote in the country's national election yesterday, narrowly topping outgoing Chancellor Angela Merkel's Christian Democratic Union bloc by just 1.8%. Merkel had announced in 2018 that she would not seek a fifth term. Her successor, however, still up in the air. That's because in Germany, the winning party does not automatically appoint the next chancellor. Instead, parliament will vote after a new coalition government has been formed. The main contender is likely to be the country's vice chancellor and foreign minister, Olaf Scholz, who the victorious Social Democratic Party put forward as its candidate. Joining us now from Berlin, Germany, NBC News foreign correspondent Matt Bradley. Matt, so good to see you this morning. Thank you for being here. Can you walk us through? A lot of people watching the show may not be as familiar with the ins and outs of the German government as you and I are. Can you walk us through the process of now forming the next government there?
Yeah, Jonathan, well, honestly, you just gave a very good summary. I've been reading some of the coverage this morning, and it really makes this seem a lot more decisive, these results, than they really are. As you mentioned, the chancellor has not been chosen. Angela Merkel will remain the chancellor. She's had the job for 16 years. She's going to stay in that post until these negotiations for a new coalition are finished. The last time there were negotiations, that lasted for 6 months. So Angela Merkel could still be in office for quite a while. This was not a resounding victory by the center-left Social Democratic Party. It was a pretty big defeat for Angela Merkel's Christian Democrats. They are now the weakest they've been in the Bundestag, perhaps ever in their history. But for the Social Democrats, they're really only a hair ahead of Angela Merkel's party. And that gives them somewhat of an advantage when it comes to forming this coalition. But it doesn't mean that they are going to be ushered into power in some sort of winner-takes-all scenario. That's not how this works. Even when they do form a coalition, even when there is a new chancellor, if it's Olaf Scholz or someone else, they're not going to enjoy the kind of broad power that they would if they had just won outright in a sort of party line vote. Instead, they're going to be sharing power. And this is probably going to be a very big share. They're going to have to form a coalition probably with three different parties, and that those parties are going to span the ideological spectrum. It's not just going to be a center-left, social-democratic kind of coalition government. The Olaf Scholz has already said last night, after these results were announced, that he's planning on asking the leftist Green Party to be part of his coalition, as well as the more libertarian kind of financial bent party, the FDP. And so this is going to be a coalition that is going to be very watered down. It's not going to be some sort of ideologically strong left or right or extreme group. It's going to be a lot like the current government. And Olaf Scholz, as you mentioned, is already a member of the current government. So we need to emphasize what happened last night and what happened yesterday. The German public did not vote for dramatic change. They voted for continuity. After 16 years of Angela Merkel, it looks as though the German public are not done with her. They want her to remain. They want her sort of consensus style, compromise style of politics to persist right here in Germany. Jonathan?
So, Matt, let's talk about Chancellor Merkel for a minute and what her legacy will be in Germany. And whoever her successor may end up being, what supportive position will they have in the rest of the world, but also in Europe? For a number of years now, Chancellor Merkel was sort of seen as the loudest, most powerful voice on the continent. Will that remain true for her successor, or will we hear from others across Europe?
Yeah, that's unclear. It depends, of course, on who her successor is. If it's Olaf Scholz, it will be probably very similar. If it's Armin Laschet, who is the sort of her anointed successor within her own party, he's a little less likely to become the chancellor. Though, again, all of this hangs on those coalition negotiations that could last for several months. Now, whoever becomes the next chancellor, they're not going to enjoy the same level of global esteem that Angela Merkel has had for so long. Angela Merkel is practically royalty at this point. She has that same kind of gravitas on the international stage, and that's why she's always, she's been called the Queen of Europe. And in many ways, the leader of the free world, at least opponents of Donald Trump when he was president, like to call her that. That mantle might be passed on now to Emmanuel Macron of France or whoever sort of takes over the chancellorship if they have that strength of personality and that leadership capability that Angela Merkel had for so long. But look, Jonathan, we have to remember that Angela Merkel was more a technocrat than anything else. She had no soaring rhetoric. She didn't impose any hardline vision for the future of Germany. I spoke with an analyst the other day, and she had a very good way of putting this, that Angela Merkel resolved quite a lot of problems, but she didn't solve the problems. Those problems, the financial and economic insecurity in the European Union, a lot of the appetite for exiting the European Union that we already saw in Britain, immigration issues, the environment, these are issues that persist, and they will continue to persist even with Angela Merkel not stewarding Germany through them. Jonathan?
NBC's Matt Bradley, thank you for this, and please stay up with this story in the days and weeks ahead. And I will say, I'm glad we got to run that picture of Chancellor Merkel at the bird sanctuary this weekend. It couldn't have been more fun. The U.S.-Mexico port of entry at Del Rio, Texas, partially reopened after being closed more than a week. U.S. Customs and Border Protection was forced to close the southern border after nearly 15,000 migrants set up camp at the site. The port reopened to passenger and pedestrian traffic Saturday afternoon. Cargo traffic is scheduled to return later this morning. Officials say most of the migrants who had gathered there were Haitian. Some have been deported, while others are still waiting to get processed to enter the United States.
Of the 17,400 that weren't deported back or didn't return on their own to Mexico, how many of them either, how many have been released into the U.S.?
They're released on conditions, yes. and approximately, I think it's about 10,000 or so, 12,000. We have enforcement guidelines in place that provide that individuals who are recent border crossers, who do not show up for their hearings, are enforcement priorities and will be removed. It is our intention to remove them. That is what our policies are.
President Biden condemned Border Patrol officers for using horses to deter Haitian immigrants from the encampment site. Images show Haitians being chased and intimidated by immigration officers on horseback, waving what appeared to be a leather rein or lariat. According to the New York Times, the Department of Homeland Security temporarily suspended the use of horse patrols in Del Rio, which had been used since the inception of the Border Patrol in 1924. On Friday, President Biden was asked if he has failed in his immigration policy and if he takes responsibility for these recent actions.
Of course I take responsibility. I'm president, but it was horrible what to see, as you saw. To see people treated like they did, horses barely running them over, people being strapped, it's outrageous. I promise you those people will pay. They will be, an investigation underway now, and there will be consequences. There will be consequences. It's an embarrassment, but it's beyond an embarrassment. It's dangerous. It's wrong. It sends the wrong message around the world. It sends the wrong message at home. It's simply not who we are.
Biden's remarks sparked outrage in Texas, where Governor Greg Abbott said he would hire any agent who faces termination.
What the president said, going after the Border Patrol, who were risking their lives and working so hard to try to secure the border, if he takes any action against them whatsoever, I have worked side by side with those Border Patrol agents. I want them to know something. If they are at risk of losing their job at a president who is abandoning his duty to secure the border, you have a job in the state of Texas. I will hire you to help Texas secure our border.
Meanwhile, investigators from the National Transportation Safety Board are looking into the cause of an Amtrak derailment over the weekend that killed three and injured others in Montana. NBC News correspondent Jacob Ward has the details.
It happened around 4 o'clock on a beautiful Saturday afternoon. The two-engine Amtrak train carrying 141 passengers and 16 crew members suddenly dragged to a halt as eight cars derailed.
Oh my God, it's on its side.
All of a sudden, it was like this extremely violent force. I'm a pretty big guy, and it picked me up and threw me from my chair into the wall.
Jeremiah Johnson and his wife rushed in to help.
They were throwing ladders up on the side to get up to the windows that were broken out to go to the people that were kind of screaming inside wanting help to get out.
They had provisioned jaws of life. They did had to cut into one of the cars to extract some of the individuals.
The accident took place in a remote stretch near Joplin, Montana, far enough from help that several helicopters had to carry the most badly injured to hospitals. Amtrak confirming three people were killed, dozens more injured, many put up at a local high school. Past derailments have often resulted from going into a corner too fast, as in this 2015 derailment in Philadelphia, according to the NTSB, or from a section of track either blocked or misaligned. Now, a team of federal investigators is on the ground in Montana to ask how this train came off a straight section of track on a clear day.
Why did the cars derail? If the track were straight, it strikes me that it's going to be something to do with the train cars themselves and how they connected with the track, or in some fault or flaw in the track.
On a per-mile basis, rail travel is far safer than traveling by car. And recent years have seen safety improvements like positive control systems that automatically keep trains at safe speeds. But rail maintenance is a constant challenge, and the condition of this section of track will be one of several variables investigators will examine as crews work to clear the wreckage from this typically well-traveled rail corridor.
Our thanks to NBC's Jacob Ward for that report.
Agnew! Still running! Agnew! Touchdown! Agnew! Touchdown! Jacksonville!
On its way. It bounces off the crossbar, and it's good!
Field goal attempts were two of the biggest plays across the NFL yesterday. First, you heard that dramatic call of the Jaguars returning a missed field goal 109 yards for a touchdown. But that exciting kick six wasn't enough to put Jacksonville past Arizona. Cardinals still win 31-19. And then that was kicker Justin Tucker drilling the game winner for the Ravens, which bounced, doink, off the crossbar and through the uprights as time expired. The NFL record 66-yard field goal gets Baltimore a 19-17 win over the Detroit Lions.
Hi, I'm Jonathan Capehart, and I'm excited to share some great news. Both The Saturday Show and The Sunday Show are available as a podcast. Every weekend, I look forward to bringing you the most important political news and the newsmakers who are creating policies that affect your life. For me, it's all about the conversation. That's when news is revealed and understanding begins. Search for Saturdays and Sundays with Jonathan Capehart and follow.
Now to San Francisco and the 49ers hosting the Packers on Sunday Night Football. We'll pick things up at the end of the fourth quarter. The Packers trailing by a point with no timeouts and 37 seconds left in the clock. Quarterback Aaron Rodgers spoiled San Francisco's comeback by completing a pair of deep passes to drive Green Bay into field goal range. And a 51-yard kick on the final play, it's good. 30-28, Packers win. Turning now, if we must, to Major League Baseball, as teams rally for postseason position in the final week of the regular season. We begin, sadly, in Boston. You know, I really tried to get this segment killed. This is a bad call and change the game. The Yankees take control of the American League wild card after that blown call and a drop third strike with this eighth inning rally, powered by the umpire's mistake and then this two-run double by Aaron Judge and this two-run homer from Giancarlo Stanton a day after he hit a grand slam to give the Yankees a win on Saturday. The Yankees win this one 6-3, and they completed a three-game sweep of the Red Sox at Fenway Park. That's the Yankees' sixth straight victory, and it gives them a one-game lead over Boston for the top wildcard spot in the American League. Meanwhile, the Toronto Blue Jays are just one game out of the second spot after yesterday's 5-2 win gave them 2 out of 3 against the Twins over the weekend. This race may, however, come down to the difficulty of the six games remaining for each team. The road is seemingly favorable for the Red Sox with a three-game series against the lowly Orioles before finishing up the season with a 3 against the woeful Nationals, while the Yankees play a series against those surging Blue Jays and end the season with another against the AL East reigning Rays. That said, don't bet against the Red Sox ability to blow this. It's still a tight race for the National League West with two games separating the Dodgers from the Giants atop the division. This one is likely to be settled by who fares best against the Padres, with each team set to play a series against San Diego before the season is done. The NL East also will look like it'll come down to the wire, with 2.5 games separating the Braves and Phillies before they start a three-game series tomorrow night. Meanwhile, the Cardinals, the surging Cardinals, are tightening their grip on the second NL wildcard spot, completing a four-game sweep of the Cubs with a 4-2 victory yesterday, their 16th win in a row. With a six-game lead for that second NL wildcard spot, the magic number for St. Louis to clinch is now down to just one. And finally, what could be the start of a new era for Ryder Cup golf? After losses in 9 of the last 12 Ryder Cup competitions, the U.S. washed away decades of defeat on the shores of Lake Michigan yesterday. America's youngest Ryder Cup team in history handed Europe its biggest loss ever with a 19-9 final score at Whistling Straits in Wisconsin. Now let's go to the weather. Meteorologist Bill Caron is here. Bill, good morning. Thank you for getting up and being with us. Tell us what things look like out there today.
Things are looking kind of quiet. You have the Orioles and you have the Nationals coming up. I mean, the Red Sox have nothing to fear whatsoever. You'll easily get into the playoffs placing those two teams. You won't choke that away. We'll just leave that at that. So it's a very quiet weather pattern out there. It was a beautiful weekend for so many people, but summer is holding on. I mean, you forget that, you know, you can notice that the sun's setting earlier, but the temperatures are supposed to be cooling off. Today is going to be in the 90s, almost all the way up into the Dakotas. It is a very warm weather pattern. We're going to have near record highs in many areas today. St. Louis could have possible record highs. Kansas City will be close. Des Moines could have near record highs. So it's going to be a very warm week ahead. And there's really no sign of any big cool down. Temperatures will return in the Midwest kind of back to normal by the time we get to the middle of the week. We also have a huge hurricane out there. We get a couple of these every hurricane season. Sometimes they head for land. Sometimes they don't. And this one is a don't. This one is even going to miss Bermuda. It's going to be harmlessly out to sea. It's a Category 4. It's a very powerful beast, but we're happy that this one, unlike previous years, will stay well off the U.S. East Coast. So for today, enjoy another beautiful fall-like day, almost like summer in some areas, Jonathan.
Bill Caron, thank you so very much. Welcome back to Way Too Early. It's 5:30 on the East Coast, 2:30 out West. I'm Jonathan Lemire. Two of the 9 centrist Democrats who threatened to vote against the budget reconciliation package until the House passes the bipartisan infrastructure bill are now on board for a big spending bill. According to Axios, Congressman Gonzalez and Vela, both of Texas, are now publicly promising to vote for the $3.5 trillion budget reconciliation package. 3 days before a potential shutdown, the Senate will also hold what will likely be a failed vote tonight on a House-passed bill to fund the government through December 3rd. Axios reports the backup plan would be a clean continuing resolution stripped of language about raising the debt, which Republicans have declared they won't support, and the Democrats spent the past week preparing. To avoid a shutdown on Thursday without a short-term funding bill, Democrats will need to attach legislation to their partisan reconciliation package that would increase the debt ceiling. Also, as Democrats race to pass the president's sweeping infrastructure agenda while also trying to avoid a government shutdown, top defense officials will testify before Congress this week on the chaotic U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan. Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Mark Milley, Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin, and U.S. CENTCOM Commander Kenneth McKenzie will appear before the Senate Armed Services Committee tomorrow and the House Armed Services Committee on Wednesday. The trio are expected to be grilled on the last month's U.S. troop withdrawal from Afghanistan, including the ISIS-K suicide bombing that killed 13 Americans and scores of Afghans. They're also expected to be pressed on an August 29th drone strike, where 10 Afghan civilians were killed in what McKenzie later called a, quote, tragic mistake. Joining us now, co-founder of Punch Bowl News, Jake Sherman. He's an MSNBC political contributor and may not be getting much sleep this week. Jake, good morning. Thanks for being here. Let's just go through it one at a time. Let's start there. Talk to us about what we can expect this week from Milley's testimony and the other defense officials we're going to hear up on Capitol Hill talking about Afghanistan.
Well, John, two things to keep in mind, right? There's the Afghanistan policy issue. There's legitimate questions about what we're doing, what we did and what we will do when it comes to Afghanistan, the withdrawal, obviously. And then number two, the, what our future role is in Afghanistan, whether we'll have diplomatic relations, what our capabilities are to combat terrorism there. So those are big questions. Then there's the political questions, right? Mark Milley has seemingly been, he's been busy, I would say, talking to book authors, and there's been a lot of information about him dealing with the Chinese and dealing with other political actors when it comes to Bob Woodward and Bob Costa's book, which is out and is getting a lot of buzz. So that's something that you'll see a lot of people ask about. Remember, this committee is filled with a lot of ambitious politicians, people like Tom Cotton, Josh Hawley, Rick Scott, all people who will want to hear answers about that. And this might be one of the only opportunities to do so. So I think that is the general situation when it comes to that big hearing, which will take place in Senate Armed Services tomorrow.
Yes, no shortage of questions for General Milley, I'd say. So as we've been laying out all morning, it's a big week on Capitol Hill, and we're certainly inching closer to the possibility of a government shutdown just after midnight if this doesn't get done. Walk us through what's going to happen this week in terms of that. How do you see this playing out? Will the government close?
Yeah, I don't think so, John. So the Senate, as you noted in your opening, will vote tonight on a continuing resolution, which also raises the debt limit. That won't pass. That will fail. And then the Senate will have to move to a clean government funding bill, which would preserve Donald Trump era spending levels. So some Republicans will be happy about that. And it also will not include the debt limit. So I imagine that will pass with a large bipartisan majority. There are some questions as to whether the Senate will shorten that stopgap measure from it's now due to expire December 3rd. They could shorten it to 2 or 3 weeks. It wouldn't be entirely smart, but that is an option for them. And then we get into reconciliation and infrastructure. Remember, Nancy Pelosi over the weekend suggested that she wants to get all three of those things passed together in this week, not at separate votes, but all passed this week. That is a lot of legislating for a month or for a quarter or even for a year, but she wants to do it in a week. So we're going to see. That is the agenda for the House this week.
Yeah, and let's stay with the Democrats and their efforts to pass President Biden's agenda. A truism on the Hill is that if Speaker Pelosi calls the vote, that means she has the votes. Is that what's happening here, Jake? Walk us through it.
No, I don't think so. I think Pelosi sees a path to getting the votes. I don't think she has the votes. And that's why I don't make much of those centrists suggesting that they will vote for the $3.5 trillion package. There is no package yet. So we have to take everything we hear with a little bit of a grain of salt. It's a good sign that people are coming out suggesting they're going to vote for this legislation. It does not mean anything yet because there is no legislation. So the big question will be, can Nancy Pelosi convince progressives to vote for infrastructure while they're getting this reconciliation bill bill together. That's a big question, but she has a couple days. They'll start debating that bill today, and then they'll vote on it on Thursday. So she has a couple days to get this done, and that's her task. Her task is to convince people that this large-scale package will get done, as will the infrastructure bill.
It was a time of pride for the gay community.
I felt like I was part of a movement to liberate ourselves.
Then came a mysterious and devastating disease.
The latest figures from Los Angeles County.
We were describing evidence of a new acquired immune deficiency syndrome.
This is a story of strength and resilience.
This is our deciding moment. Together, we are greater than AIDS.
Commitment to life. Sunday, April 28th at 9 p.m. Eastern on MSNBC and streaming now on Peacock.
It's been over a year, but the Tonys are here, and now Broadway, 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 to love, Broadway, 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 Broadway is back.
Time now for something totally different. Broadway is still buzzing from that, the return of the Tony Awards last night, finally celebrating the best in theater from before the pandemic. Moulin Rouge the Musical, a stage adaptation of the Baz Luhrmann film, came away with Best Musical and 9 other awards, the second highest statue count for a musical ever. The Inheritance won for Best Play, and A Soldier's Play won for Best Play Revival. Best Actor in a Musical went to Aaron Tveit of Moulin Rouge as the category's sole nominee, while Adrienne Warren took home Best Actress in a Musical for the Tina Turner musical. Andrew Burnap from The Inheritance and Mary Louise Parker from The Sound Inside won the Top Performance Awards for a play. In the latest New York Times documentary, Controlling Britney Spears, new allegations against Britney Spears' father, Jamie, claimed that he hired a security firm to surveil the pop star, his daughter. Alex Vlasov, who worked for Black Box Security, the firm hired by Spears' father to protect her, claims the firm mirrored the star's phone to read her text messages and planted a recording device in her bedroom to listen to her conversations under the direction of Jamie Spears. Recording conversations in a private place and mirroring text messages without the consent of both parties can be a violation of the law. In a statement, lawyers for Jamie Spears told the New York Times, quote, all of his actions were well within the parameters of the authority conferred upon him by the court. His actions were done with the knowledge and consent of Britney, her court-appointed attorney, and or the court. Jamie's record as conservator and the court's approval of his actions speak for themselves. A statement from the CEO of Black Box Security's lawyer read in part, quote, Black Box has always conducted themselves within professional, ethical, and legal bounds, and they are particularly proud of their work in keeping Ms. Spears safe for many years.
At some point, I'm not sure when, but I'll let you know, we'll be doing it in public.
Following the CDC's decision to back Pfizer's booster shot for some Americans, President Biden says he'll receive a third dose of the coronavirus vaccine. Meanwhile, the chief executive of Pfizer says his company will move forward with efforts to get children eligible for the company's COVID-19 vaccines within days. Last week, the pharmaceutical giant announced the first set of promising results from a major vaccine trial. The trial, which has not yet been peer-reviewed, found the child COVID-19 vaccine, which is about one-third the dose that's given to adults, is considered safe and well-tolerated among 5 to 11-year-olds. This comes as pressure grows for the FDA to approve a vaccine for children as pediatric cases rise exponentially nationwide. Meanwhile, a vaccine mandate has been temporarily blocked for the nation's largest school system. The mandate, which affects well over 150,000 workers in New York City, required employees to have at least one dose of a coronavirus vaccine by tonight. But late Friday, a federal judge granted a temporary injunction sought by a group of teachers and referred the case to a 3-judge panel. They're expected to take up the motion on Wednesday. As of last Friday, 82% of department employees have been vaccinated, including 88% of teachers. Joining us now, President and CEO of the Biotechnology Innovation Organization, Dr. Michelle McMurray-Heath. Doctor, thank you so much for being here. Good morning. Let's start with this. What would you say to those who oppose a vaccination mandate in public schools, whether that be teachers or other school staffers?
Well, I'd say they're about 50 years too late. We already have many vaccines mandated for kids to go to school. Almost 14 diseases are vaccinated against routinely in our schools across the nation. And we have to think about protecting the most vulnerable among us. We are seeing rates of pediatric COVID increase, and that is unacceptable. Children have no choice to go to school. We have to make every choice possible to protect them while they're there.
So we just saw President Biden say that he'll get a booster shot when he's eligible. But the booster shot debate has divided medical experts, especially after the FDA advisory panel recommended the emergency use authorization for the Pfizer shot for Americans 65 and older and those at risk, but rejected extending boosters to people under 65. What do you think? Was this the right call? Are they approaching this the right way?
Well, they're being very cautious, and the data is still rolling in. A lot of the data that we got from Israel about booster shots being incredibly effective, we saw first in those 65 and older because they were the first to get vaccinated to begin with and therefore the first to need boosters. So we expect more and more data to be coming in. You know, it's not unexpected that FDA is being perhaps overly cautious in this situation. FDA has gone almost 9 months without a permanent commissioner. Their funding is not completely assured. We need to do everything we can to support this critical agency so that they can speak with a clear voice, they can increase transparency, and they can make sure that the American public comes along with their decisions and has confidence in them.
It also seems that there's sort of rather wide leeway as to what Americans might qualify under special circumstances to get that booster. Doctor, one more for you. Just now, we're talking, Pfizer is saying that they think they could be on track for asking for emergency use authorization for their children's vaccine, ages 5 to 11, not younger than that just yet, maybe in a matter of days. This would certainly be an extraordinary step, a relief to a lot of parents. When that starts happening, what do you think that will do to change the face of the pandemic here in the United States?
It's critically important. Look, we thought we were going to get this data over the summer, and FDA went back and asked Pfizer to do a much larger pediatric study. So now we're doubly assured of the safety and effectiveness of these pediatric doses. And we've seen since the opening of school, pediatric cases increase. So it's so critically important that we get these doses out. As the mother of a 9-year-old, I can tell you I'm waiting with bated breath. And everyone is hoping that FDA will get this out to the American public by Halloween. That being said, they're up against the clock because Germany has already announced that they are assured that they're trying to get their pediatric doses completely out by the end of October. So the U.S. doesn't want to be the second in line here. We want to be first. And so we urge FDA to just get through reviewing this data as quickly as possible and put children in a more safe situation.
I've got a 10-year-old and a 6-year-old, so I hear you precisely. Dr. Michelle McMurray-Heath, thank you so much for being here. Come back soon. Earlier in the show, we asked, why are you awake? Matt in Minneapolis emails this. The cows don't quit, and I have a trailer full of milk that needs moving. Thanks, man. Jim sends us this very clever picture, which I can only assume is a reference to his housework and not the Yankee sweep of my Red Sox. And on that note, a good friend of the show writes this. Hi, John. I'm up way too early to welcome you and your fellow Red Sox fans back to the Orioles neighborhood. You have all forgotten what it's like. Thank you, Casey Hunt. We miss you.
Hey, everyone. It's Chris Hayes. This week on my podcast, Why Is This Happening? We're back with another installment of our special series with Pod 2024, The Stakes. I'm talking to experts about both Joe Biden and Donald Trump's records on specific policy areas during their time as president. This week, economist Kim Clausing on taxes.
Underfunding the IRS really serves the interest of dishonest people at the top rather than your typical worker who would benefit from being able to get their questions answered and getting their returns processed in a quick way.
That's this week on Why Is This Happening? Search for Why Is This Happening wherever you're listening right now and follow.